Welcome to the podcast, Text to Task, Simplifying Education. Today, we are excited to have Professor Pamela Bernard, an expert in arts, creativities, and education from the University of Cambridge. Let's explore the interesting realm of classroom creativity and find out how it's present in the simple things we come across every day. Professor Bernard will share insights, tips, and stories that show how creativity is easily accessible in education. Get ready for a conversation that uncovers the powerful impact of creativity in unexpected places. Enjoying your time today? You can help others find these helpful tips by liking and sharing this podcast. Be sure to subscribe to my bi-weekly podcasts. I'm really grateful for your support. Pamela Bernard is a professor at the University of Cambridge. With 20 books and over 100 articles, she contributes to the theory and practice of multiple creativities across education levels. Her recent works include co-edited books on sciences and arts creativities, rebellious research, and creativities in music education. She is involved in funded projects such as Choices, Chances, and Transitions around Creative Further and Higher Education, and Creative Learning in Higher Education, Teaching of Bioeconomics. Pamela Bernard is a fellow of RSA, Chartered College of Teaching, and ISSCI. We look forward to gaining valuable knowledge from your expertise. I understand that you have a busy schedule and making remarkable contributions to the field of education. Thank you, Professor Pamela Bernard, for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for asking me. I'm indebted, I'm honored, and very happy to speak. Thank you.
Let me start. Can you share with us your personal journey and experiences that led you to become involved in the field of creativity and the arts?
This is a beautiful question. I love this question, and I'm going to try and be as brief as I can. First, you know, whenever one asks, how did you come into a space? How did you get where you are? You have to go back to the origins. And I come from a little country town that you probably would not have heard of in Australia. I am Australian. I'm one of five children, the last, the baby. I had two older brothers, a big space of 6 years, two elder sisters. All of both but brothers and sisters feel like uncles in a way. And then there was a 6 year gap and me. And I came after my parents had sold all their baby stuff, thinking there was going to be no one else. And of course, that gave my brothers and sisters the opportunity to say, oh, you weren't wanted. You know, you're not even one of us. You were adopted. You know, the sort of thing that siblings do. Well, with each of those statements, I think it fueled me because I felt like there was more. I knew there was more. And I knew my mother said, you know, you were a change of life, baby. And, you know, I said, at the time, I think I was 25. Yeah, babies change your life. I get it, you know, but I didn't get it. She was 49 when she had me. And so I had older parents, and there was something about wanting this sort of desire, this motivation that there was more than this little country town. And yet I love this country town, but I knew, and country towns have a magnetic pull that people who come from country towns will know. You always get pulled back to that place. But I felt I needed to get out, and this is where the arts come in. I was playing the piano, going through grade one, grade two, grade three, getting up early before school and practicing, And by this stage, when I got to grade six, my brothers and sisters had all left. They'd got married because I was much younger. So I was practicing, and in the end, still as high school, I was practicing at 4 o'clock in the morning to do grade eight and this thing called Associate of Music. And music seemed to, it was this pull. It was the place that I could kind of speak. I had a voice. And I also competed in competitions under 14, under 16, and was winning. So I was getting this very positive affirmation that, you know, there was something going on here. So I ended up going for a 4-year Bachelor of Music in Melbourne Conservatorium. My abiding memory, which was a prize for topping the year four, to play with the orchestra, Beethoven's Fifth Piano Concerto, The Emperor. And people who know classical music will know The Emperor is as big as that name is. And I don't remember anything. I don't remember walking. I don't remember walking, getting to the conservatorium that day to perform. I only remember walking across the stage, sitting down. I remember every note and the feel of a conductor and an orchestra, and finishing. I remember every note. I remember that moment of completion, kind of surviving that experience. I don't remember walking off the stage. They tell me I didn't collapse. I wasn't taken out in an ambulance, but this is a sort of significant critical incidents, what I'll come back to often in our conversation about in our life. We have these moments when you have a critical incident, and this was a, you know, sort of a moment where I felt I'd come to a place in my life that was really significant. And all those practicings of 4 hours, you know, 4 a.m. in the morning, had come to something. And yet I still didn't know what was ahead. I didn't have a vision of becoming a professor in the University of Cambridge. I just had this kind of, at this point at 21, you know, this moment of completing a 4-year degree and thinking, I'd got out of my little country town. I had a, you know, a university degree, and that this was going to be a ticket, a kind of a launch into something. And that moment, I don't know why I don't remember anything else. It's got something, I think, to do with performance anxiety and just getting ready for that moment. And then it's when it's over, the, you know, you go into an exhaustion, or even feeling a sense of shock that it's over. But the body and the mind work in sync, and arts, you know, the performance of art, the performance of music, this voice that brings to you has always been so important. And that brings me to now. Today, here in Cambridge, I spent from 9 to 1 at an induction of doctoral students that are doing professional doctorates and the EdD. They're all working professionally in institutions, in business schools, in organizations, in education, in psychotherapy, all wanting to make a change by doing a doctorate. And, you know, I said to them, where we begin, like my memory of walking across the stage in the 4th year of a bachelor degree, like lifetimes ago, this all contributes to where we are at the moment. And the thing about the arts is it enables you to have a voice and to enable other people's voices. So we started this event with wool, with 4 balls of wool, which it's a task that I give, where I throw a ball of wool, which to someone, we're in a circle, and you ask them, tell us one thing about yourself. And that person then sends that ball of wool to the other person. We're standing in a circle. what one thing about yourself. And it's about this me search, which is sort of what we do. We're always me searching. Who are we? What are we doing? What's now? What's next? And this is a line of flight that literature tells us. Deleuze and Guattari, who are French philosophers, use this metaphor of a line of flight, which a life takes, which an idea takes, which art takes, and it intersects with other lines of flight. So you end up with this sort of web of identities that are in the room. And then I pulled up another ball of wool, another color, and asked another question, which was, what is the topic of your research? You know, if we know what me search is at this one aspect, what's research? And through this ball of wool that went around the circle, kind of creating a web of intersecting lines that connect this community. Now, this is an artistic kind of practice that I've used with children, I've used with adults. It just works with in any setting, really, because wool is beautiful. It's a beautiful feel to it. And it kind of connects to childhood as well. You know, you think of the wool that your grandparent or, you know, your mother might have made you a scarf or you know, a top or something. But wool has a homely, warm, trusting feel about it. And to throw it to someone where the line, you keep one end of it and the wool reaches them and they answer the question, you end up with this lovely thread of like a spider's web of interconnecting lines. And that's what, you know, I think I'd like to end with this question of saying, that was one memory of me at sort of 20. I think I was 20 actually at the time. And what followed were two masters. One was in the States, one was in Australia, and then coming over to the UK to do a PhD after working in creative industries as a professional artist, working in education in primary and secondary sectors, and now in higher education, which I call my third sort of career. It came from the beginning, which was I had a fire in the belly. I knew there was more, and I knew I wanted to make a ripple, you know, to just make a difference, either to me and hopefully to others. And that it all started by just getting up at 4 a.m. and practicing the piano. I knew it was a ticket out of this space, the motivation, but it was also what arts do. It invigorates, it generates ideas, and it kind of launches you into spaces of possibility thinking. What if you could win a scholarship to go to the States? What if you could win a scholarship in the UK to do a PhD? Anything is possible if you've got a fire in the belly. That's what started being fifth of five from a little country town in Warrigal.
It's a very inspiring story. Building on that, could you elaborate on how exposure to different forms of art can impact an individual's ability to think and approach challenges?
Yeah, it's a great question as well. You've got great questions, Garki. I'm going to refer now with that question to a publication in a book that's called Creativities in Arts, Education, Research and Practice. And it's part of a series called Critical Issues in the Future of Learning and Teaching. And the chapter that I co-authored looks at three art forms. One is dance, which is a sort of embodiment of embodied arts practice. Another is a STEAM practice, which was done in a school, inspired again by an artist, looking at kind of engaging with STEAM, and the third was artistic creativity in a HE, higher education. But I'm going to go to the first one. The first was working with a choreographer, which is of course dance, and from Denmark, and she had this incredible intercultural creativity where she worked with Danish artist dancers, and she worked also with Icelandic dancers, and she wanted to kind of bring an eco-artistic kind of practice forward, addressing water sustainability, looking at the melting of the Arctic circles, and through dance, and how she expressed that through this intercultural, from a sort of indigenous practice with these Icelandic dancers to working with Danish formally trained but contemporary dancers, meant that we understood this question, you know, of water sustainability differently through dance. And then the second one was about a sculptor called Nicola Ravenscroft, who's a London sculptor, and she created these children. They were called With a Heart of a Child and a Penguin, and she had these life-size children representing each continent in the globe, along with a penguin in the middle. And these children came up to Cambridge and were kind of launched at a conference that I was leading, and then ended up in a primary school called the University of Cambridge Primary School for a year. And these children inspired their lifestyle, life size. So children at a primary school would walk up to these children that were each molded kind of from life-size children from different continents. So their hair looked different. There was certain sort of characteristics that represented different parts of the globe. And the penguin that was in the middle. And the penguin had hair that actually you could play like a piano, like a thumb piano. And so he you put your hand on his tummy and then flicked his hair, and there was this amazing sensing of sound and children just adored this. And the fact that this was a sculptural kind of object that they could play with and think with and imagine with. So you put them on silk, blue silk, and say they're in water and they're in a different, you know, kind of part of the world. What's the significance of being on an island to being children on a continent in an enclosed country, you know, like Germany, for example? What is it to be in the Northern Hemisphere, a child? What is it to be, you know, in the Southern Hemisphere? And they would use their imagination and take storying and looking at all sorts of siloed subjects inspired by children and a penguin. And it was an amazing project, and it's been published around the idea of STEAM education from these particular inspired topics, when teachers also had a few days to brainstorm, what can we do with this sculpture that's been left in our school for a year? What does this inspire? What do artists inspire in terms of the meeting of arts and science? So that was a second project, that arts inspires us to meet with science, because it is a natural meeting that was always there from the, you know, from Leonardo da Vinci. It's only been falsely separated by political agendas. Let's bring the meeting of these subjects back, because we see it in industry. We see it in practice, in real world practices, that people need to have these subjects meeting in order to solve problems. The third one was really exciting, and it's still evidenced in the Faculty of Education, Cambridge University, where we won some money to engage with the question of what do master's students learn when they do a master's degree, full-time and part-time, because the part-timers would come in, you know, for 2 years, and the full-timers would come in for 1 year across mathematics masters, across psychology masters, politics and democracy masters, arts and creativities masters, researching practice masters. We have many different thematic masters. But at this time, we had full-timers and part-timers. And in all the evaluations, the part-timers were not happy about how we were running these courses right across those masters. So we hired an artist to come in for a term and to lead us in reflective practices across the term. And we documented everything. And now, if you come into the University of Cambridge, and I hope you do, to the Faculty of Education, you'll see from the third floor to the ground floor, there is this analog documentation of that project, which had many themes. You can also find it on, if you Google, I'll remember the name of it as soon as I look at it. It was called Facultatum, which is a sort of mixture of faculty and tatum, which is sort of a Latin for art. Look that up, Facultatum, and you'll see an analog blog and a digital blog. The digital blog shows all of the activities that were led across that term that we analyzed in terms of what is it to do, you know, further education, to do a higher degree as an artist, as a mathematician, as a teacher, and what happens in that process of transforming, you know, from who you were when you before you started to what you become when you keep reading and writing and thinking and troubling all the things that we normally just accept in our professional and indeed personal lives. And that again took an artist to kind of to create the catalyst for us to reflect differently. And that's why art is such an imperative, and we see it in real world practices. Organizations are employing artists to get their organization to think differently, to do differently, because they think differently and there's a freshness. I'm wearing a t-shirt at the moment that says think, and there's a box, and think is written outside the box. So to think beyond traditions and conventions, that's what artists do. That's their thing. You know, they think beyond, and to be helped, assisted, partnered across disciplines to bring those silos that are, see subjects that are siloed, to bring them together again, because they were together, you know, centuries ago in Leonardo da Vinci. Just Google him and you'll see he drew pictures, about 400 pictures of drawing water, hitting water, because he was given a job by an Italian council to harness water. So the first way, what he did was just draw water, hitting water, hundreds of drawings. And those drawings, they have a certain style about the sort of curve. And what he did was then use that technique to create artwork, along with inventions, flying machines, the body. Think of the Vitruvian Man, you know. I mean, that was the technology they had, a pencil and paper, and human imagination, along with more than human interaction, because he was interacting, allowing the paper and the pencil to act on him, like now we allow the technology to act on us. So that is also in partnership with us now, centuries later. So art, I think, is at the center. Just walk outside and you see it in nature. Look at a flower. What an amazing design flowers are. It leaves, you know, look at the root system that's under the earth and see how trees talk to each other. It's extraordinary. The art, we're surrounded by what, swim in the sea and the feeling of the sea, but the fish are, you know, designers. And of course, design is inspired by the sea. So art, what are the arts contribute? And well, you know, governments across the globe are not seeing, they use the arts as a sort of, you know, a way of thinking we can save some money here, but you know, it doesn't in the end. But the name of the chapter is chapter 17. I'll just put it here, just start writing it just so that you've got it. It's called Connecting Arts Activism, Diverse Creativities and Embodiment Through Practice as Research. And that's the other thing. When, you know, you practice whatever it is you're doing and you research what you're doing, then we come to understand the significance of it, document it, mobilize it, and it has impact. Okay, what's your next question? Thank you.
So expanding farther on, what practical strategies can educators use to encourage creativity in their students within the classroom setting?
This is another great question. I honestly, Garki, you've got fantastic questions. And this time I want to, you know, in terms of the practical strategies that educators can use to encourage creativity, I've seen this mobilized by a school in Cambridge, the University of Cambridge Primary School. You know, I invite your listeners to Google University of Cambridge Primary School, James Bidoff, book series on releasing research. And he has six books in this series. And what he's done is invited teachers to write about their innovative practice with each other or with academics or with researchers or with artists. And there are six books in this series. And these are teachers, you know, when you ask what are the strategies that teachers, educators can engage in new creativities, one is to research their own practice. Actually look at what it is you're doing and what you can do in consultation with their students. One example was in Finland, a teacher, which is in the book called Sculpting New Creativities in Primary Education. And this particular teacher came back after COVID in Finland with very unhappy students, very demotivated students. So he consulted them. And what happened, his name is Jukka, is the teacher, Jukka. And he asked his students, what do we need to do to kind of rekindle the fire in the belly to get you motivated and to get you excited about schooling? And he consulted them like, you know, a government might consult certain people in a profession. And they came up with this idea. We want to move our bodies more. We don't like being in seats in rows all day long. We want the classroom to be reconfigured. We want it to look like a gym. And so he negotiated with his head teacher and, importantly, with the parents to give him one term where His classroom would be set up like a gym with running treadmills, with rings that you could hang off, with ladders that you could climb up and sit close to the roof and read from the top of a ladder, that, you know, all secure, all safety, you know, kind of measures met, from treadmills to even kind of a hammock where kids would lie down or roll themselves up in the hammock like a pod and read the book looking that was sitting on the floor. These weird, really weird kind of ways of acting that you wouldn't think of as an adult, but children found these spaces and ways of working and configuring, and the relationship to the space changed. He also had well-being measures that he had at the beginning of the term, in the middle of the term, and the end. So he was measuring well-being. He was measuring, of course, the achievement and looking at what was changing across the achievement levels that were being, you know, kind of documented across the term. And of course, it's probably not surprising that because the kids had said, this is what we want, that it actually made a change, that the teacher listened, that the parent agreed, that there was a negotiated arrangement with the head teacher. So you had this, okay, we'll give it a shot. Well, for a term, it was outstanding. It was significant. So they agreed that the teacher could keep doing this, keep measuring, keep documenting. And of course, now Yuka, Y-U-K-K-E-R, is doing now his PhD in his classroom, measuring, documenting, and theorizing what changes when young people, these were 12 and 13 year olds, actually enable this embodiment, engaging their bodies in ways that adults, you know, we just go to the gym, don't we? We go to the gym and we do our hour and then we come back and do everything else. And these are segmented hours in the day. Whereas these children were saying, no, we want to listen to our body, not feel demotivated, but actually go to a space in the room which will motivate us. And usually it's through the body connecting again with the mind. And so this separation of mind and body, but also the sort of artistic authoring and understanding of what bodies need, you know, came into play. So back to this question, where, what are the practical strategies that educators use to encourage creativity? One is through research as practice. Researching their own practice.
Classroom.
Second, doing something like a master's where they've got to do a project, a research project on their own classroom or some aspect, actually just pulling out one thing changes how educators, you know, encourage their own creativity. Another way is to co-author, you know, with someone else, to actually partner with, you know, another teacher or an artist who's coming into the school, or, you know, someone from a university that is wanting to understand classroom settings differently. That looking inside one's own practice and partnering with someone who's interested to make sense of it, to challenge same old practices. So these practical strategies to get involved, you know, in some sort of project that could be to do with, you know, Erasmus has projects across Europe where there are classrooms, they're looking to share practices with other schools. So to get a hub together with other schools, looking at how can we change, you know, how can we shift thinking and motivation in terms of mathematics, because mathematics is often thought of as a really ugly subject, as a sort of not relevant, it's too hard. You're either good at it or you're not. It's a bit like music. And when teachers come together and form collectives, power comes into play because they start talking, they start thinking about this question. What if this possibility thinking? What if? Even partnering with people in industry to get industry in the school in Cambridge, this University of Cambridge Primary School, they actually get the engineering second year students to come into the school for a week. So these engineers are in a primary school with the children across, you know, early years to grade six, and they each of the sort of groups have an assignment that they do collaboratively with the children, working with cardboard to create, you know, a vision of a new city or a vision of their community gardens differently. And at the end of the week, all of the children in the school want to become engineers. That's, you know, and surprisingly, there are some engineers that think, I don't think I want to be an engineer. I think I want to be a primary school teacher. You know, so it's really interesting to kind of mix up, you know, bring those things that are often not meeting that should be meeting. Why not have engineers come into your school for a week? We've seen architects really interested in children's perspectives. In Cambridge, there was an architectural company that wanted to get children's perspectives on what they see in terms of buildings and constructions, and their perspective on kind of thinking about urban design. So they gave children cameras, really nice cameras, started from the top of a street in Cambridge, Castle Road, for those that know, which is at the top of a hill, and you come down into Cambridge past places like St. John's and Trinity College and King's College onto cobble roads with these very small kind of doors that are embedded within very big doors with, you know, 800-year-old university. So what is it that a child sees with a camera? Well, the architects were blown away by the perspectives, literally the perspectives and perception of children. What gripped them were things that don't grip adults, because we don't see keyholes. We're not at that level. We don't see the handle of a door. We don't see cracks, you know, in the woodwork and the kind of things at that level. And it really opened the eyes of these architects to such an extent that they now have a children's panel, sort of children governors, if you like, kind of consultants that are on their panel to get children's perspectives when it comes to urban design, or when it comes to the building a school. What should the playground kind of involve? What should it have? You know, tree houses, of course, chairs, but what dimension? You know, the imagination of children is extraordinary. So to consult children, you know, this is not a new idea. None of these are new ideas. These are not my ideas. These come from people like Jean Ruddock, who was a absolute activist and researcher extraordinaire for Pupil Voice in Cambridge. And she said, and now deceased, I go into her grave once a term to just acknowledge the contribution she made to me as well as the field. She said, change comes from inside the classroom. Inside the classroom. And it's inside the classroom in collaboration with the teachers and the pupils, the children and the teachers. Or if you go into higher education, you know, the lecturers and the students. And I have a research grant at the moment with higher education lecturers from Italy and from Poland and from Portugal, and we're looking at creative learning for bioeconomics, which is a subject in most universities, especially economics, especially sustainability subjects, especially to do with sustainability and earth and soil creativity and so forth, climate change, you know, water sustainability. Why me? Because they're wanting to look at how to create higher education lecturing practices that really embody creative learning rather than just standing out the front talking. And that meeting of, you know, working with these people who are not my tribe, they're economics people, they're to do with the, you know, sustainability of soil and soil maintenance and water management and food management and waste and so forth, which is nothing I know nothing about that except for what we know is the public. But I do know a lot about creative learning and teaching and how to enact change in terms of how we engage students in thinking differently. But how to get lecturers to do differently, that's different and it's tough. But that's what we're working on for 18 months, and it's a great, I'm loving the project because it's transdisciplinary and it's challenging and it's contemporary and it's timely. And we're consulting students, you know, second years particularly, students want change. They want to see things done differently. And so there is a real, I'm really hopeful for the future, because I think the teachers do want to, despite how hard they are, kind of driven down by government policy and so forth, they really want to see change. And I see that back to James Bidoff and his University of Cambridge Primary School book series, which is promoting research from inside the classroom with teachers leading on change. And I think that's where it is. It comes from inside the classroom, from the teachers. They want to change things and they want to write about it. Yeah. I'll give you that book series as well so that you can share it with people, because I think it's really inspiring. These chapters, it's across six series. There's one on curriculum change, one on the one that I sort of edited the series is on sculpting new creativities in primary school. There's one on pupil voice. There's one on special education needs. There's one on democracy in schools. But they're voices from inside the classroom with teachers. And I think that's what teachers want to read. They want to read their profession. What are they saying that I can then, in 6,000 words, I can read that in an hour, even over lunch, you know, and we can talk about it over a sandwich. That's what they want, not to read, you know, a volume of stuff, but to get it snapshot and get inspired and get on with what if I was to do that, possibility thinking.
Okay. In relation to my last question, what do you think it's beneficial for schools to mix different subjects with art?
Beautiful question. It's a beautiful question. Why do you think it's beneficial for schools to mix different, you know, if we go back to Leonardo da Vinci from the Renaissance, you know, that's what he did. That's what everybody did. They didn't have these subject silos. Now, you know, to what extent are these subject silos working. When we see governments speak about the pipeline of mathematics and science and how girls drop out of mathematics because they just don't like it. Well, is that their fault or computer science? They don't get into it. Why aren't girls being engineers? What is it about this pipeline, as if these subjects, literacy and numeracy, are it, when actually the way we experience the world is something much more integrated. And let's learn from South Korea, who call STEAM education convergence education. Now that word changes how you think about the meeting of science and arts, convergence education. And if you think about even this wonderful thing that I can't live without now, this thing called an iPhone, this was created by teams of transdisciplinary experts led by Steve Jobs, who called himself a conductor. He was conducting these different expertise people to bring together something that was so aesthetic. He was really inspired by Japanese aesthetic. When you buy something, I resisted for years. I thought, it's too expensive. I'm not going with, this Mac stuff. And then I bought an iPhone, and it was just opening the package was just such an aesthetic experience. And even now when you buy a battery, you open them and it's an aesthetic experience. It's sort of the mixture of arts, aesthetic, sensory stuff, but even if you're not a Mac person, don't be put off by what I just said. Any smartphone brings together arts and science. It's in the performance of that tool that we engage at such a level. Who knew that we needed it? Well, now I can't live without it. And I never knew that. It's the most extraordinary thing to have a phone that is actually a computer, that I can make notes, all the things that So let's bring together arts and science. And I co-edited a book called Why Science and Arts Creativities Matter. And in this book, we reconfigure STEAM for future making, or the futurity of education. Because it's too late to think that education is about preparing kids for the future, because the future is so uncertain. And actually, the children that are in school at the moment have to be designing new ways to think about the future. And I was involved in a study which looks at Singaporean children designing Singapore differently. What would they like to see? These were 12-year-old children designing Singapore for the future. And one of the many, many ideas, really futuristic ideas from the imagination of these children, one had roads off the ground. And the road under the roads was grass, lots of green and blue, so that lakes and green. So nature was sort of the eminent kind of feature. Roads were above that, and indeed, the cars in the main were in the air, and there was just this sort of balance of humans, more than human, which is nature and species, all other kind of contributing collaborators to how we live through nature, with nature, and non-humans, which of course is technology. And this is sort of what it is to be a 12-year-old. I'm not 12. I don't know what it is to be 12. But wow, coming out of the minds of 12-year-olds, are this futurity education. They see a need. They're hungry to change it. I didn't think about future of the earth and the globe and the world when I was 12. I don't even think I was thinking of my own future when I was 12, just thinking about how to exist every day. It's hard being 12. I found it hard being a 12-year-old girl in the country. I had questions, but they weren't about futures and earth and planets and sustainability. They were different questions. 12-year-olds now, indeed, 6-year-olds have these questions. So we need to be thinking about education very differently and thinking about subjects and the relationality of knowledge, not, you know, the way of knowing and the way we know subjects and how they connect and interconnect differently. Because we don't have time to take children off into science classes and labs, maths, physics, and music and English and language and whatever else, media, separately, and hope that they connect them sometime in the future. We need to do that in their education. So that means a very different kind of, you know, whether it's a flipped classroom, whether it's thinking about curriculum timetables as space tables, where you're thinking differently about space and time and what's possible with curriculum. It requires major school ecologies thinking and doing differently together. And I think it's possible. I'm seeing it. There are some amazing schools, pockets of incredible practices. Some of them are written up in this book on why science and arts creativities matter. It really tries hard not to just be an academic kind of, you know, something that's too hard to kind of get your head around at 10 o'clock at night. There's a section on STEAM reconfigurings in practice, part 4, where people are writing up their practice. And if that's the only bit that you read, which is 100 pages, well, great. You know, you don't have to never read a book from cover to cover. I never get time unless I'm on a long-haul flight to Australia. Can I ever get from the beginning to the end of a book? It's not possible. That's why these podcasts, and thank you, Garki, for organising this, are so important, because you want a snapshot. So, you know, drawing from these ways of thinking about, you know, these references, you know, I the biggest compliment I've had is that I don't sound like a Cambridge professor. Thank you. I don't want to sound like a Cambridge professor. I want to sound like something that's much more impactful, that's connected to real world practice and that's connected to real time 2023, that connects with you, the listener, and in excites you to just read one thing or rethink one thing. If you don't want to read anything, just think about what if tomorrow, you know, I was to do something different. If I was to author or co-author to something in your street that you'd like to see change, co-author with your street a change to whatever is not working in your street or in your school or in your community. Because I think we are the authors of change and we can do that. And it starts with co-authoring, you know, that collaborative creativity.
Actually, the basis of this podcast is having engaging interviews and enlightening discussions to share teaching strategies, research findings, and innovative approaches with everyone.
Wow, great. Of course, the question is, the last question that you must ask me must be about family, because parents are central. And I want to to say that, you know, engaging families and the wider community are absolutely central to change. You know, supporting families, supporting, you know, collaborative research across cultures. And this is being done. But again, it's, you know, usually funded research in little pockets. It's not wide, you know, it's not at this point wide enough to bring about a real, you know, kind of significant change. But professional learning is key. Teacher education is key, which is professional learning. Never enough funding, and never done in such a way that teachers really feel like it's worthwhile. I'm in this University of Cambridge Primary School, a professor in residence. I go there for 2 hours a week, and I sit with 4 half-hour sessions with teachers who are wanting to either research their own practice, research a question, get involved in funded research, or they're already doing a master's and they want some support beyond their supervisor. And I bring in articles that are relevant, save them a bit of time from searching, and just talk, you know, for a half an hour about, you know, how the writing process might look. These are little acts of kind of kindness, care, support, that if everybody did one act of kindness, you know, next week, that was not with payment, but just goodwill, I think the world would be a better place to learn, you know, through each other, from each other, and to respect the time poor. Many professions are time poor, and people who've got expertise, you know, should be sharing it. You know, of course, they've got a job, they've got a mortgage, they've got families, of course, but to also share it with some sort of community engagement is something we should all think about doing, and supporting, you know, those that could do with a bit of support from us. So that's another thing that is important in terms of authoring change.
So can you walk me through what specific steps could parents take to support their children's creativity?
Okay, one, listen to them. Listen. And that's not so easy, because children are often not engaging because they're fixated on a screen. So, you know, beyond the screen, you know, play peekaboo. You know, do you see me? And look at the YouTube. There's a YouTube of a girl called Molly, who's 7 years old, and she speaks of the power of peekaboo and says, for parents are often on screen, they're often on their laptop themselves, not interacting with their children at breakfast or at dinner. You see it when you're on holidays. I do family ethnography, so I can't stop myself on a beach. You know, family, Italian families on beaches are a beautiful to behold, because they're laughing and they're buoyant and they're flamboyant, and there's grandparents, parents, children, and they're playing, and it's so interactive. But then there's another aspect of that where girls are taking photos of themselves all the time, fixing up, photoshopping and putting it on, and you see they're not even present to the beach. So, you know, what do you see when you go and have a coffee with your friend and look at other parents with their children on a Saturday morning, and say, what are we doing as a family? You know, how are we interacting? And it's really hard, because children are really mimicking parents in terms of, I've seen so many times four people at a table, two parents, two children, they're all on their phones. And it's very sad to see. So interact, you know, make a pact, make set of rules where there it's no iPhones, no phones, no phone, just talking. Kids are not going to like it, but too bad. Start talking and start listening. Have elephant's ears. Listen with your body, listen to their bodies, and engage with these children. They're so young, they're not going to be with you for long. So engage. That's my first thing. Engage with your children. The same thing is true, of course, teachers, to really listen, not to what you think you hear, but to what actually isn't being said, that's said in a different way to what, you know, verbal. So listening, I've read a book recently called Hungry Listening. Just Google that name and I can give you the reference, Gargi. Hungry listening. That's what we need to do. And hungry listening is sourcing Indigenous listening and Western listening. And it changes the way you think about how we listen or not. So that's my first point. My second point is to find ways that children will engage with their interests. What are they interested in? You know, okay, if they're interested in, you know, just fixated with technology and screens, then tap into that and get the members of things like an Arky Maker club. Arky Make, A-R-C-H-I, Make, and I'll give this to you again, Gaki. It's a STEM architecture and design school for young people. And I was invited into London to go to one of these Saturday morning sessions with 8 to 16 year olds with their parents from right across socioeconomic sort of strands, funded and subsidized by, of course, it's going to be a, you know, one of the big companies, digital companies. But they were doing incredible work with fun, designing their bedroom, redesigning their learning how to redesign public spaces like outside their house, redesigning a building with their own kind of value systems, and actually learning to create archetypes to build it as well. And I'm talking about these young children and that were really fired up to either become architects or engineers or designers, you know, design, but getting into design and getting certificates that contributed to GCSE and A levels. And parents were investing, you know, a couple of hours on a Saturday morning. Of course, that is an investment somebody's, you know, got to do, whether that, you know, that, and that just is part of the parenting thing. Not everybody can. So sometimes they've got to find communities that help to collaborate together. So find the interest that your child has, joining, you know, a coding club, joining, you know, a sports club, swimming, you know, or a dance club, you know, doing hip hop, for example, which, so it doesn't have to be those kind of classical ballet, but a hip hop club, and finding that sweet spot that the child has. And then they actually have a voice that's theirs, not yours, not the parents, not the aunties, not the uncles, but their voice, because we don't know what it is to be 20, you know, 12 in 2023. But the Arky Maker Club, I was so impressed. And there are other clubs like that. So I think it's about, you know, really And this club was not expensive. It wasn't just for the elite or privately schooled kids. It was subsidized. It was inner London and it was very diverse. So, you know, you just got to look and listen, and we can help you find the club that maybe you need. Communities are amazing how they do this work. You've just got to look out. Yep.
Regarding your previous response, how does engaging creative activities influence an individual's overall well-being and mental development?
Honestly, that's another great question. There's a lot of research on well-being, and actually during COVID, I was writing a chapter for UNESCO with five or six other people from other universities across the globe, bringing together voices, and I'm happy to give you this reference, which looks at a sort of synthesis of all the literatures on what is social and emotional learning. What is it? Social and emotional learning. I mean, we think of learning and we think of, you know, literacy and numeracy, but what's social and emotional learning, and what contribution does that make to the well-being of children and young people? And this is probably the most important question of all, and one of the key answers that we saw in this chapter, which I'll send on to you, is that, you know, arts practices, community arts, you know, djembe playing, anything that is an expression of being a human, and that can be playing football, which is also an art form in my world, in my thinking. It's connected to all sorts of spatial and elements, and being a collaborator and a team player, and actually thinking, possibility thinking in the moment as you get the goal and do all stuff. And it's so sort of balletic in so many ways. But people separate these things, of course, because of the siloed subjects. But back to what is it that you can engage young people that grip them, and things do grip them. And often things grip them that parents don't even know is gripping them. And so how to kind of get into their world sufficiently so they can support what it is that's gripping them. And I bet, you know, some sort of arts practice is there at the center of that. Even on TikTok, it's an arts practice. They're dancing, they're communicating. To get them off TikTok, I would suggest, is a good practice, and take that more into a community rather than an online kind of platform. So I think it's about communication. I think it's about interacting, intra-acting. Let the child act on you. Let them act on you, like technology acts on us. Earth, nature acts on us. Let your child act on you and see where that takes you both. The arts is all about, you know, not just human practices. It also involves collaboration with more than human, nature. It can be an arts practice. It's in gardening. You know, there's a chapter in the book Sculpting Creativities in Primary Education, which is on steam gardens. And it looks at how gardening is equally about science as it is, you know, about mathematics, how much water and how much growth is, you know, required, what happens in terms of water sustainability, growth of species, of what's going on under the earth, under the ground, in the soil. The soil creativity is a question. And not to mention the aesthetics of actually planting a plant and just seeing it do its thing, you know. So I think we've got to get back to nature. You know, I know that's an old adage, but back to nature and just to communicate, to intra, not just interact, but intra act, which is this where you acknowledge the collaboration of something, that a thing that acts on you, like a pencil acts on you, a color of a pencil acts on you. And it does when children are drawing, you know, when they draw a tree and they draw it in colors that are not like you'd normally see a tree. This is incredible. So why do parents come along and say, trees are normally green and brown, why have you made it pink and orange? You know, well, that is the way they see it and how it acts on them. And those colors are extraordinary kind of ways of portraying things called trees. So, you know, stop judging and just start celebrating the authoring of ideas and this thing called what if. What if we were to think, what else can we think about using our imagination? And, you know, I think this would solve a lot of problems. But, I hope I don't sound like a, you know, just a, you know, happy, chappy person that sees the world. I know that there are huge problems with this. There's huge injustices and huge inequalities. And this is just a very superficial kind of moment of breaking it down into generalization points. But if you want to read some of the references, maybe it'll take you deeper into why I'm enthusiastic. And I can only see the glass, you know, half full. I can only see it in a positive way, because I think humans are amazing, and I think if we listen to children, we'll make it.
Thank you, Professor Pamela Bernard. It has been an honor to have you in this podcast. Your wisdom and profound insights have brought an unparalleled richness to our discussions. Thank you very much for your contribution. I eagerly anticipate engaging in future conversations with you.
Yep, I look forward to that, Gaki, and I want to say to you, thank you for your vision and wanting to reimagine, you know, what the world can be when people listen to each other and have that hungry listening that I was speaking about. So thank you very much for inviting me.
Until next time, embrace the creativity around you and continue to find inspiration in the ordinary.